As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello Ruckers, welcome to the latest edition of The Ruck, your rugby podcast from The Times and Sunday Times. We have another packed show ahead. We'll be dissecting Eddie Jones's England squad for the Autumn Internationals, reviewing the latest round of Premiership Rugby, including a record victory for Saracens against Bath. We'll be hearing from Jess Hayden on the latest in the women's game, and from Christian Day, the head of player affairs at the RPA, on the debate surrounding artificial pitches and male players being now allowed to wear leggings. I'm Alex Lowe, and joining me this week are Stuart Barnes and Alan Dimmock. Morning, fellas.
How are you doing, Alex?
Well, I'm all right, thank you. How are you guys? Al, where are you?
I'm in Scotland, so the air is clearer, the water's nicer. People actually make eye contact when they say hello to you. I'm just loving life.
I'm in Wiltshire, where there's no people around me, and that's just fine at the moment.
What are you doing up there, Al?
Much needed holiday, but I had to push everyone aside and say, no, this is important. I need to go on the rock and talk to the guys.
I'm broadcasting. That's what you said. Family outdoors, go for a walk. I'm broadcasting.
I said, I need to go and talk about Bath's record defeat and see how Barnsley feels about that. Although there is one thing rugby related up here that everyone's talking about. You know, I don't know if anyone's noticed, but in the United Rugby Championship, there's been some howler decisions. So there's been some tries given that really should not be given as tries. And it transpires. There's no referees manager. And considering last time I was on, Stuart made such an impassioned plea about standards of refereeing, there's an open role there for Barnsley if he wants to go in and sort out refereeing.
Yeah, can I just say, though, I mean, I watched Sale beat Harlequins Friday night, and neither Raffy Quirk tries should remotely have been given, and we've got managers or referees in England, but they're still making a horlicks of decision week after week, game after game. And I did talk to one DOR, and it was off the record, and when I was asked talking about that game Friday, and you know, he said I've been in touch just about the standards. There's real concern, I think, amongst DORs about refereeing at the moment. They either give quickly without seeing what's happening, or they spend forever looking for the decision. And if you're going to do that, get it right or just get on with it, I think. I think that should be the motto, get it right or get on with it. But at the moment, we're halfway between one and t'other.
Stuart, are you grumpy today because Bath shipped 70 points? Or are you grumpy because last time I saw you, you had an enormous gin and tonic in your hand about five rows in front of me at the Rec, and are you feeling the effects today?
I must dismiss this line of attack. One,
It was enormous.
Well, I am not grumpy. This is, as Alan has said, this is my normal situation vis-a-vis refereeing. And it has been, it was when I was playing the game, and it certainly is at the moment. The gin and tonic looked extremely large. It was in a pint-sized glass. But you're not allowed to take glass from the president's room where my dear friend John Hall is residing president. So I had to take it in a large vessel, and it was hugely tonicked up.
Are you drinking out of a vase? Did you nick a vase off somewhere? There's some flowers lying around the room.
No, I considered that come the second half. But the first half, I just thought I hadn't seen Bath play in a role as a spectator since 1994. I've seen them lots of times at home, but only as a broadcaster or a writer. And the sun was shining, and Adedeo Adebayo was there, and Hawley was there. And I thought, wow, take my wife there. What a nice way to pass a Sunday afternoon, having filed on time. And it was. One thing I'll say, Saracens were magnificent. Our gut reaction is to say, my God, what happened to Bath? But they were bloody good. I would say God, what happened to Bath?
God, what happened to Bath? Well, we'll come on to that. We will work out exactly what went wrong for them or what went right for Saracens shortly. Firstly, though, today, Eddie Jones has named his England squad and we'll be discussing that next. So the England squad for the Autumn Internationals against Tonga, Australia and South Africa has just landed in my email. Mark McCall said after the game at the Recreation Ground on Sunday that he would be amazed if none of his Saracens contingent were in the squad. Well, Mark McCall, stand by to be amazed. There is no place for Maka Vunipola, Billy Vunipola or Jamie George or Ben Earl. George Ford is still on the outside. There's no place for him. I'm just going through it here. Dan Robson is absent from this squad, which is a pretty significant selection there, I think. He's out. But Rafi Quirk and Harry Randall are in, along with Ben Youngs. Al Stewart, have you had a chance to have a look at it? What do you make of it? The couple of uncapped players have come in too.
Yeah, I think the interesting one, I mean, one of the things that jumped out at me there was looking through the list of players that are uncapped is when you notice that Jamie George isn't in, Nick Dolly has come in, and that's a form selection for a young player that's doing really well at Leicester. But, and then, as you mentioned there, the scrum half, I mean, hookers and scrum halves, the legacy of Eddie Jones is going to be that from the day he came in to the day he leaves, we're going to be discussing his selections at hooker and his selections at scrum half. And Ben Youngs is going to be the one constant there. So we've got the young lads that are coming in. Dan Robson, off the back of maybe getting 15, 20 minutes against Italy every Six Nations, is ousted.
At fly half.
And these young lads are coming in. And Ben Youngs is there as the constant safety net. Mm. It's an interesting one. Like, are these young guys going to let them have a go against Tonga? And then as soon as Australia comes in, a big test, he's not going to give him a go. It's just really interesting to see what he does with that. But certainly those are just looking at down that one. The only other thing that stands out to me is, and it's something that we probably was on the cards anyway, and I think we discussed this a little bit off air, was the idea that whatever happens, with no George Ford there, that's actually a significant thing for the character of this team, because the Ford-Farrell axis for so long as part of this England leadership group has dictated what the attack's been played like. Mm. Whatever happens now, it's going to have to be completely different in tone, or it probably fortifies the position of Owen Farrell. Not that it was needed, but suddenly it just changes the mood around things. What have you made of it, Stuart?
Obviously, the headline's not who's in, the headline's who's out. But one thing I would say, we're all sort of jumping around and shouting, saying, blimey, Billy Vunipola, Maka Vunipola, Jamie George, they're all playing so well. They weren't playing that well for a couple of years. And I think Jones has, I ain't defending him for once. I think he's taken a long view and to a certain extent has decided that, you know, two or three good games doesn't make up for a season plus of mediocrity. Now, obviously, that isn't a consistent view, because if that was the case, Owen Farrell, who played very well against Bath, has played hardly any decent rugby for nearly 2 years, and he remains as captain. So it's not consistent, but there's I understand what Eddie Jones is looking at here. It looks to me, personnel aside, very much like squad selected to maximise England's opportunities in Paris 2023 rather than necessarily beat both Australia and the Springboks this coming autumn. And I think that's significant, and I wouldn't agree with a fair few of these selections, but in terms of the philosophy of what Jones is doing, I think you can't place equal importance on every single international. You have to make a plan. Jones was always told and was always admitted the World Cup was the main aim. And this looks to me more a World Cup squad of 34 than an Autumn International 34.
Another interesting thing that pops up here is it now becoming survival of the fittest at number 8? With Billy Vunipola out, you know, after his card couple of years, his form hasn't been enough to see him to see him secure a place in this. But if you look at Alex Dombrandt with his one cap, if you look at Sam Simmons coming back into the fold with seven caps to his name, you talk about whether Callum Chick's in there, you talk about whether Curry is in the running for number eight as well, and whether that's a long-term plan. Is this a case, do you think, or maybe it's not, I'm just spitballing here, do you think it's an opportunity where it's like, right, throw a weapon in the middle, whichever one of you survives gets to keep the number eight shirt?
I don't think it's far off that. I think I agree there's elements of both of what you said there on the makeup of this squad. Eddie said when he named that first training camp squad a few weeks ago that he was looking to build a new leadership team, and he's confirmed Owen Farrell will continue as captain, which, as on a tangent, it is fascinating for the makeup of that midfield, because if Owen Farrell is captain, then he's either starting ahead of Marcus Smith at fly half, or he's going to play alongside Marcus Smith, presumably with Manu outside centre, which
it looks like Henry Slade, who has been a fair constant with Eddie Jones, is not going to be starting these games. There's no way Eddie Jones is going to go Marcus Smith, Owen Farrell and Henry Slade. He's made this mistake with three non-hefty carriers. England's best midfield has Tuilagi at 12, so a 10 has the options. He's, as I said, he's compromised himself on Farrell, and he ain't going to back down on that. But that does mean outside Farrell, England have to have power, because they don't have a giant on the wing either. You know, fucking a singer. They don't have someone coming off the shoulder, the Nandolo type. So it has to be Tuilagi. You cannot play Smith and Farrell without having Bossel at centre. And if you've watched Henry Slade of late, he's done some lovely things. But I've seen him about three games this season, constantly caught behind the gain line, trying to ghost on an outside angle. And, you know, when I watch games, I try and think, what would Eddie Jones be thinking there? And I think, what does Eddie Jones think when an outside centre gets caught behind the gain line? It's not something that we can repeat before midnight, at least.
So he's confirmed Farrell as his captain, but to go back to your initial point about the Vunipolas and George and Ford and their form, I think he has decided to keep them on the outside because he is trying to build underneath Owen Farrell a new leadership team, which he's already said that was one of his intentions. So I think you're looking down this list now, Tom Curry will step up, Courtney Laws will step up, Ellis Genge will step up, and Marcus Smith will step up. And I think to Al's point, if you had Ford and Farrell, who have been so integral to the way that England attack has developed and has been run for the last 4 or 5 years, if Marcus Smith comes in with those two there, I think it's very hard for him to take on a senior role, to have his voice heard in those conversations, because he's coming into a setup that already works. What Eddie Jones is trying to do here, it looks like to me, is create a sort of a chaos, if you like, within the squad, where he's got a flurry of new voices, new leaders, new ideas, and give him an opportunity to develop. And that, I think, is as much as anything else, is why those senior players aren't there. Because those senior players who didn't perform in the Six Nations may have performed pretty well in a couple of games this season. But this is, as you said, Stuart, I think this is a longer-term view of what is this group of players who are going to lead this squad into the World Cup. And I think you'll see new leaders stepping up underneath Owen.
And the constant churn as well. It's a bit like an ocean, isn't it, where you see the waves, but there's all sorts of stuff happening underneath it. When you think the fury that's been in Jamie George's performance, to go with the clinical nature of it, see how furious he's been. See how committed Billy Vunipola, who's been flipping in and out of games for years. See how focused George Ford has been. All of this, I think Eddie Jones will be sort of smiling to himself, saying, it's all happened since I bombed him out of the squad. The season had hardly started, and look how well they're playing. So I agree with you, Alex. You set up your new leadership group there, but beneath it, you've got three or four core players who, if they keep getting better and better through the autumn, through Europe, are going to be knocking on the door for the Six Nations. They're going to be hungry again. And it's almost like this three-month period when they're not going to be there has fueled them to go again. So, yeah, the more I think of it, the more I think there's one or two things where lots of our colleagues, including ourselves, might say, what a terrible selection. But I would look at this in the broad context. And in the broad context, I like it a lot.
Nick Dolly and Tommy Freeman are two of the uncapped players, both of whom knew into the squad. Neither of them were in that training camp a couple of weeks ago, both of whom are there on form. I think the Freeman selection is interesting because if you look at some of the players who have been there, I'm just going to look at the bat line. Sorry, I'm just going through this list now as this is breaking news here. Ollie Lawrence, Louis Leiner, Joe Marchant, Ollie Slightholm. They're just a selection of players who were there and have been jettisoned, and Freeman is in. Al, you were nodding.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking, like, who's wearing the 15 shirt for the whole of November? Because it's kind of like what I said earlier about the number 8 position. Freeman coming in purely on form now, and he's not a stranger bringing guys in just to be around the environment and learn what it's like to be in an England camp and be around elite players, and then slink away and go, right, here's a list as long as your arm of things that I'd like you to work on. Here's a number I've plucked out of air. I would need you to be 37.5% better at X. We know Eddie's going to do that, but, you know, Max Malins, Freddie Stewart, Anthony Watson, it'll be interesting to see who they're going to nail their colours to the mast and say, I'd like that to be our 15 going ahead. Did Stewart show enough in the summer? Has his form been enough for him to go, you know what, this guy's the long-term future at 15? It's an interesting one to ponder.
Eddie's looking at... In the first game of the summer, he picked Max Malins on the wing and referred to his old Brumbies team where he had Joe Roth and Andrew Walker both in the same back three, and liked the idea of Malins on the wing for his not just his pace and finishing, but his aerial ability. And of course, we saw Malins play on the wing only yesterday and run a hat-trick past Bath, looking electric going forward. And I wonder whether that's part of his thinking. He's got Malins as a versatile player in that back three.
Listen, there's also, we haven't mentioned Furbank, who's been spectacular for Northampton. And I think this Freeman on form would not get in over Louis Leiner. Leiner's been in the squad. I don't know what Eddie Jones has made, but he's had a taste of it. It looks to me now Freeman ain't going to be anywhere near 23 for the test, but he's going to get a taste of it. So he's really going quite deep there. And Furbank, Jones has an affinity with Southern Hemisphere coaching. He's always been, you know, whatever we think of Eddie Jones, he's always said, look, his obsession has been, we've got to beat the All Blacks. They're the standard bearers, and they are. And in Chris Boyd, there's a very smart coach who plays a quite typical New Zealand game. He just lacks a bit of impetus and power from one or two to set the back line alight. But Furbank is hugely rated by Boyd. And I know he's talked to Jones about it. And he gives a different element. I mean, to England, to me, I think Stewart is the favourite to play fullback. He's a rock. He's strong under a high ball. He blew a terrible 2-on-1 against Worcester, by the way. So he's far from the complete player, but he has a physical presence, and I like that. And I think Furbank has an aerial-like ability to flit all over the place, weave spells and confuse people. And I like that sort of capacity there. And if Malins is on the wing, it really means England are very, very strong on their options, which leads me to say one other thing about the back line. I'm quite surprised that Johnny May has held on. I don't know what you think about May's form has been pretty ropey for a while, but Eddie Jones has stayed loyal there.
I wonder if he's one of these players who, if I know he's one of these players who Eddie Jones sees as a sort of a glue player, one of the sort of senior, but not in that upper echelon of the leadership group, but a really important player within that squad. And he seems to have survived, like you say, where some of those more established leaders have had to make way. I think maybe he's one of those in the back line who will be asked to step up and take a leadership role within the squad.
Yeah, Johnny May's very much seen as, I think, as a diligent analyst and someone where if you've got loads of new faces coming in, he gets the pattern, he gets what the project is, he reads the game the way that England coaches want him to read it. It's one of these things where when you look at a squad like this, and we've already, Stuart's mentioned it a little bit, it's as much about what people can learn in about it and how much people come together as a group as much as a full whack. And if you're going to make a lot of changes, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater, can you? So if there's all these new faces coming in, it's not a massive surprise that you'll keep hold of some guys who have done right by him in the past.
So there we have it, coming at us live as we record the pod, the England squad for the autumn and their tests against Tonga, the Wallabies and the World Champions. Coming up now, we'll look at all the Premiership action from the weekend.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Gallagher Premiership goes from strength to strength. So some more incredible games this weekend. As we've already mentioned, we know where you were on Sunday, Stuart, and we'll come to the Bath Saracens game. Were you at Worcester on Saturday?
I was, yes, I was at Worcester. I thought I won't see a more one-sided game in the Premiership working for the Sunday Times than that. All I can say is I wasn't working for the Sunday Times the next day.
48-3 it was to Leicester. I mean,
48-3, and all I've written it again and again and again. I believe that professional sport should be decided on pitches and not in boardrooms. And spiritually and soulfully, right now, Worcester do not belong in the Premiership. They won one game last season against London Irish. They beat London Irish at home, first game this season again. They haven't beaten anybody else on the field. They're woeful. As for Leicester, they were in third gear, but I like the shape to their game. George Ford played beautifully, but as he said to me after the game, you know, the difference between club and country is huge. And Leicester have, frankly, the biggest crowd pleaser in the Premiership in Nemani Nandolo, who gave us a passable Jonah Lomu, albeit against Worcester and not England. He was swatting men off, and then the inside pass, the skill of the man is extraordinary. He's just a great player to watch.
Yeah, just on that, I think he's a great player to watch, but just to, I suppose the finest example of where these two teams are in that game was the moment where Matt Scott sighed right through the Worcester defence, no one touched him, and who was on his shoulder but Nandolo to just give a wee slip to, and that was try time. But at the start of the game, yeah, it was just the writing was on the wall, it felt like, from an elder. I mean, I wrote down here, magnificent seven, just because it's the easiest thing to say, but 7 points clear in the Premiership. So, fine illustration of just how dominant Leicester have been. Seven tries against Worcester, and their seven, Marco van Staden played like an axe murderer. And in fact, that entire Leicester back row were just brutal. Like, and the front row that they've got, there was a lot of talk about the resurgence of Dan Cole coming in. But the fact that you can play Montoya, who was probably the only or one of the only plus points for Argentina in the rugby championship. I mean, it's terrifying to think. And then Ellis Genge as a captain. It's just the signs are all ominous. And, you know, the way that they're rolling at the moment, incredible. There's a lot of talk about performance versus fun, but when they're winning like this, you feel like we're sort of returning to something. Don't you get that sense?
Well, that's, I mean, it is fun to watch a team that are so direct and so powerful. I thought Liebenberg as well. Every week I see him, he's magnificent. Is he going to be the next Tiger who ends up in the Springbok camp? Very, very fine indeed, Leicester. There's no question. I'll just say, I did, before they played Saracens, write a piece before the game saying they would beat them, and that they were contenders and it wasn't hindsight. And I only bring up this smug comment now because in yesterday Sunday Times, I said Saracens are having problems scoring tries and they duly racked up 10 against Bath. So.
Well, John,
are you done with that before someone else has a go?
Yes, I'm glad you got in there before we did.
So, Jonathan Thomas, having been on the receiving end of another beating, did describe Leicester's performance as the most complete Premiership performance he'd seen, which... A bit like your view on things, Stuart, as you won't see a more one-sided game. That statement probably lasted about 24 hours until we all got to the wreck on yeah. Sunday and saw a Saracens performance which was as close to faultless, particularly for the first 40 minutes, as you'll come across. I remember Nick Tompkins blew a try because he didn't quite hold on to a break in the midfield. But pretty much everything else was perfect. The way they defended their own 22, and Bath had a lot of the ball and a lot of the territory and came nowhere near scoring. I think it was 5 entries, 0 points. Saracens down the other end, 6 entries, 45 points. 6 tries, 6 entries, 45 points by half-time. It was as close to perfect a half as you'll ever see, wasn't it?
Yeah, it combined. Efficiency was a word I haven't seen too much used in relation yet to the performance. But they were incredibly efficient. They were overwhelmingly powerful and they were so big-hearted in defence. It was magnificent.
No, I agree. Mark McCall said to us afterwards that they showed how well they can play that day and it was their best performance for some time. And I guess it was one of those games that, I don't know whether they've been reading your columns, Barnsley, but it felt like they came out with some fire in their bellies, really with something to prove, and it took Mauro Itoje 5 minutes to make his mark back on the Premiership. And you had Billy Vunipola on both sides of the ball, magnificent. Ben Earl, Alex Lazowski, a player who I've never understood why he was ditched so quickly from England, given what he can do, again, on both sides of the ball. You're right, that final 20 minutes, Bath had lost the fight. They conceded 2 tries just before half-time. They just seemed to give up. It was
The light went out of the eyes.
Yeah. And then the wreck, as they trooped off, the wreck was sort of a hushed, stunned silence. I mean, literally no one's seen it before. It was the worst half that any team had ever played in the Premiership, conversely the best by Saracens, who pushed on and scored 10 tries. And as you say, I think it was a real statement. But on Bath, Stuart, I thought seeing them at Bristol before their bye week, there were some really positive signs. I thought it was a game they should have won, a game they could have won. The way they played was bold but accurate. What's your take on everything that seems to be going wrong there?
Well, first of all, Mr. Dimmock, our front row expert, is furiously raising his hand. So, Alan, I've done quite a bit. What's your take? I'll come on with the ex-Bath view in a minute.
Well, because of the Bath performance, I learned a new word this morning. I was scouting around, and there's a medical condition called dysergia, which means the lack of muscular coordination. But actually, you can use it people have been using it on the internet as dysergy, the opposite of synergy. So you are less than the sum of their parts.
Yeah.
And that's kind of either definition you look at there is kind of what it feels like with Bath at the moment. Whether you say it's a lack of muscular coordination or whether you say they're lesser than the sum of their parts, something ain't working. And it just feels like for the talent that they've got, if you looked at it on a team sheet, you'd say they should at least put up a bit more fight than they've got. But Stuart's right. It just felt like in the last half hour of that game, it was a case of they were wincing, expecting collisions that were going to come. And that's bread and butter for Saracens. They eat that stuff up. Stuart, as a former player, I mean, is that the thing that you find most galling? Or is it, and is that an easy fix? Is that something where you can go, right, you know, if we have something that freshens it up around, people will catch on to that?
I feel a sort of loyalty to the memories of the past as opposed to where we are now. I don't think Bath belongs to anyone, and it didn't hurt that much, really. You know, I'm not close to the club. I don't get there. So in the end, I was able to sort of look at this one and say what went on. And I would say that one thing you both said, first of all, you talked about you look at the team 1 to 15, and I'd agree, but there's an issue that goes beyond that. And Alex talked about he thought Bath were going somewhere from their Bristol performance. And I too did, Alex. And I think what none of us has mentioned here, and the problem is, Bath's front five is decimated. And the Bristol game, the Bristol pack are playing poorly at the moment. So we didn't realise how poor it was. And normally, you know, if you talk about then and now, and then was 30 years ago, you know, you can't compare because professionalism and fitness and, you know, the sheer, how many times have we had that thing about how big they are now to how big they are then? Yet I watched that game yesterday and I reckon my old Bath front five in the 1990s, not relatively, could have gone out there and could have put it to the current Bath front five. And I would never say that about any situation in any sport. It was astonishing. And we didn't have a giant front five, you know. I think Coochie would have caused some mayhem. Ollie would have muscled in the line-out. We didn't normally win line-out, but it was... Whew. With a front five like that, you know, they're not going to concede 71 points a week, but they ain't going to win many games. And, you know, where are they now? Play five, lost five. It's there to see.
A lot of the focus now is on that coaching setup, is on Stuart Hooper as the director of rugby and Neil Hatley, the head coach. Stuart said after the game, when he was asked by those of us who gathered around to talk to him, that he knows there'll be questions asked of him. I'm pretty sure that that Bruce Craig will have some questions, and there is talk of Steve Diamond being brought in a role to, you know, and there's a very experienced director of rugby who you would, the kind of character you would imagine would put some steel into that pack, would not stand for some of the sort of sloppiness and almost craven surrender at times in that game. I felt. Do you think, Stuart, it's time for a coaching change at the Rec, or at least a new voice to come in and give some experience?
And you never like howling for change immediately after. It always feels like sort of gut reaction, which is a dangerous thing. But this isn't hindsight. I mean, if you go back through the Times and Sunday Times, I was adamant that Stuart Hooper should never have been appointed as DOR because I didn't feel he had either the experience or the credibility or the feel for it. I think Stuart Hooper works really hard, but he has little feel. And I think a rugby club has to have feel as well as an ability to micromanage. So, you know, I don't think he's the man for Bath, and I never did. I don't think, to be honest, it was... In fact, I know he wasn't Bruce Craig's appointment. He was talked into it. And there'll be some things being spoken behind the scenes there right now. And, you know, the only thing I'd say about Steve Diamond, I think if Bath's a broken body, Diamond can almost pull him back from the grave. He's like a sort of... remember those sort of Victorian criminals who used to break into graveyards and get up the old corpse and then they turn them to life? Sort of Frankenstein thing.
Broken hair.
Steve's brilliant at that. And if Bath are looking for someone to just pull him round, then he's your man. But this is a year without relegation, so there's no sense of urgency as there often is. And is Steve a long-term appointment? I don't think so, because Bath's a very different sort of club. But no, I don't think he is. If you're just saying, let's get someone in for 9 months to steady the ship, and Steve Diamond wanted that, he's a good call. If you said, who's going to replace Hooper, I don't think it works.
Yeah, absolutely. And it feels like this is just a predictable tail end to what has been, what I've heard some people describe as the banter era at Bath under Bruce Craig, where we've seen some scattergun signings, some guys that have never really hit their straps at the club, tying together. It's never felt like a team that's tied together And when they pulled off great results, you can say fantastic, because there are some incredible characters within that squad. But it just feels like there's something that needed to paste them together. We're talking an awful lot about Bath, but I want to talk about one moment in this game that stood out for me, and it was a really interesting moment, is when a forward, Billy Vunipola, pulled off a sumptuous 50-22 kick that went into the corner. And this is in a weekend where we'd seen a number of fine 50-22 kicks. Delahunt for Connacht, the hooker, hoofed his way to a nice 50-22. Antoine Dupont corkscrewed a beautiful 50-22. And in the summer, I remember talking to Jake McIntyre, who'd been a fly half for Clermont Auvergne. He'd gone back to Super Rugby to play in Australia. And he was telling me that in Australia, when they where they initiated the 50-22, they hadn't really scratched the surface about how useful a tool it can be. And we're starting to see now how useful that can be. And he said he predicts that it could become a fantastic attacking weapon. At the same time as I was interviewing him about that, one Stuart Barnes was saying that he thought it was going to be a horrible addition to the game. And I was just wondering if Stuart is now going to take his opportunity to say to the nation that perhaps he was a bit wrong about the 50-22.
On the ruck, am I going to admit to being wrong twice? Saracen, yes.
Good point.
The 50-22. And to be honest, Al, I've been watching that and thinking about it, and it is developing in ways that suggest that it's my aversion to it is that World Rugby seems to come up with so many sort of bits and pieces, alterations. I just thought, here's another one. Watching it in the flesh, it looks like I might have to make a second confession on the programme. Yeah, that Vunipola moment, when he did that, I was sort of laughing at myself again then, thinking that this can work. Although what it does do, you got to remember, it puts the ball dead again. So it's great in one way, but what you're doing to get the ball back is stopping the game, because you watch them come up then, it's another minute gone as the pack amble like a herd of cows towards the next line out. So you're still losing live game time. But overall, I'll say, Al, yeah, okay, your knife just about found its target. It didn't pierce my heart, but at the moment I'm bleeding.
I think it is interesting watching how that tactic develops, because Orlando Bailey went on a break late in the game on his own and almost stopped himself before he crossed the halfway line and executed a kick into the same corner as Billy had done. You think that if he'd carried on going himself against that Saracens defence, he'd have been tackled and turned over. And actually, it was quite a smart piece of play from him, I thought. And you saw the week before a cross kick from Marcus Smith in his own half. The reason he could do that was because Bristol had some defenders back covering the 50-22. There was more space and more variety to the attack. And it's one of those laws, I think, is going to evolve as teams work different ways of playing it.
Yeah, that's one of those things that Magdar said he predicts will happen in Europe, having played in the top 14. He said, we'll see lots of guys going for the corner and folk will cover that. But the more useful kick tactically could end up being the one that dissects people right down the middle of the park and finds grass, because we all love a chase in Northern Hemisphere rugby, and there's a lot of that. But at the moment, at least, it's just, I think I just want to celebrate the fact that the bigger blokes are putting boot to ball. And if you're a coach and kids, it doesn't matter what position people are playing, let them work on their kicking.
If you're a coach of premiership clubs as well, here's the flip side. You know, when something is good, something goes wrong. And the other thing we've seen people making busts through the middle there. But I say to you, if Billy Vunipola wanted to offload to someone, everyone has stopped as he geared towards the kick. So we're going to get to a culture where everyone, prop forwards, number eights, they'll all be able to drive a ball into the 22 for a 50-22. But in the process, we will lose the art, which we won't lose the art of support play, because in the Northern Hemisphere, we've never had it. But we'll get even worse, and the New Zealanders will still flood through when they make a break, and the Aussies will do that. But we will stop there and we will wait to clap our hands and say, brilliant kick, we're in the 22 with a line out, as opposed to under the post with a try. So the flip side.
It is interesting. It'd be a good one to watch how that develops over the season. We've talked about Worcester. We've talked about Bath. I mean, all is not well in the West Country. Bristol lost again up at Newcastle. And I don't know if anyone saw any of that game or has any thoughts on, because I think Newcastle are a team who are you know, kind of the opposite to Bath. They're, you know, they're forging a unit there under Dean Richards, who are probably greater than the sum of their parts.
Yeah, well, and as he said himself after the game, it's 3 wins from 5. We'll bite your hand off for that. You know, entertainment value, I don't know. There was not a single point scored for 36 minutes in that game. And when it was, Callum Chick went over from about 30 centimetres, spun past loads of defenders and went in. But I tell you what, you bloody take it. And it's interesting to see, you're right, that element of synergy. And it's, once again, we're talking about Chick, the way that he's played. We're talking about Jamie Blamire, who got a couple turnovers in that one, and you know where he is in the pecking order around the country is a really interesting one. But it's sort of like it's almost like they've gone, we don't care, we're going to play the Falcons way, and this is how it goes. And by the same token, it also shows you the value of kickers, because Conan, who got a yellow card at one point in the game, slotted over a couple of kicks. Johan Lloyd for Bristol missed a couple, and that's the difference in the end, because it was a low-scoring affair. So it shows you, if you just get that little bit of edge, if you just got that little bit of grittiness, which, let's be honest, they've got that in spades at the Falcons, sitting prettier than previous times.
There's also one massive difference as well. You look at someone like Bath with all their assets, but they've got as director of rugby Stuart Hooper. Newcastle, without the assets, have got Dean Rugby. Dean Richards.
Dean Rugby.
Dean Richards of rugby. if you want to know about the value of having a top-class man running the show, think about Bath and think about Newcastle. It's there for you to see, loud and clear.
And the weekend kicked off in Manchester with Harlequins, the defending champions, suffering their first defeat of the season, and maybe a bit of a reality check for Marcus Smith. Tom Curry said in our paper on Saturday morning that, yes, he's a hell of a player, and yes, he's playing some great rugby, but he hasn't played against our defence yet. And on Friday night he did, and came up on the wrong side of it.
Friday night sounds horrible. Quins had lost 6 on the bounce there, I think, Alex, hadn't they, going into the game? So people said, there you go, that bursts their bubble. It doesn't burst their bubble. Teams will lose. You know, Saracens have lost this season. It's not the end of the world. It wasn't a great game.
As a big fan of forward play, I mean, it was brusque stuff from Sale, and it's, you know, there have been a couple of times this season where they've reached the second half of games and they've completely lost. But this was not that. And John O'Ross even recovered from a yellow card to come in, and he was just, in the nicest possible way, horrible. Like, they were just horrible to play against. Made good use of a maul, and it's something that we're going to be talking about more and more and more, particularly as we monitor how these 50-22s are going, at the way that Leicester Tigers are playing. It's something that's just going to really shape the narrative as a weapon throughout this season.
I think that's the Premiership pretty much covered. We're going to hand over now to Jess Hayden from The Times with all the latest news from the women's game.
There are no games in the Premier 15s this week as the players are in their international camps preparing for the busy autumn international schedule ahead. The Red Roses are in their second autumn camp already as they prepare to start their schedule against New Zealand on the 31st of October. Would it be trick or treat for Simon Middleton's England side? The team is without their all-time top point scorer, Emily Scarrett, who is recovering from a broken leg. But they are boosted by the return of Sarah Byrne, the Bristol Bears prop who missed most of last season through injury. England have the most fixtures this autumn, playing New Zealand twice and also facing the USA and Canada. Wales women have enjoyed their first camp in the new training centre at the Principality Stadium, where they are getting ready to face Japan, South Africa and Canada. The new centre is a sign of the investment to come for the side, which is currently entirely amateur as no player is paid to represent their country. Heading north now as Scotland prepares to play just one match this autumn against Japan. Last month, Brian Easton's squad played in the momentous final match of the Rugby World Cup European qualifiers, where they produced a stunning performance in the final minutes to edge in front of Ireland and confirm their place in the final qualification tournament to give them one last chance to qualify for the World Cup. Ireland are still bruised from their failure to qualify for next year's Rugby World Cup, having hosted the last one. They have 2 test matches this autumn against Team USA and Japan. Both matches will be played at home as supporters can watch the women's side play live for the first time since March 2020. The side is also without Claire Molloy, Ireland's captain for the 2017 Rugby World Cup, who retires after 12 years in the green shirt.
That was Jess Hayden from The Times, rounding up the latest in the women's game, and she'll be with us every week. Now, last week you may have read that World Rugby passed a new law which allows male players to wear leggings in matches for the first time. It follows further criticism this season about the injuries and the friction burns that players pick up playing on artificial pitches. World Rugby listened to complaints from players in the Premiership via the RPA. So we decided we should speak to Christian Day, the head of player affairs at the RPA, to hear about the burns, the issues, and whether many male players will end up wearing these leggings.
My role at the RPA around sort of player affairs is listening to player opinion and feedback and just trying to help the players in any way I can in terms of that representation, which goes on behind the scenes pretty much 24/7. So yeah, player raised the concern that they were particularly susceptible to friction burns from AGPs, and we've got four in the Prem now. So, you know, if you're going to be playing just under a third of your games on them and you're susceptible to these burns, you know, could we do something about it? And looking into the regulations, they were already in place for women to wear, and it just seemed a pretty common sense approach that adding that layer of protection as a player's choice, like I say, it was just common sense, and World Rugby pushed it through pretty quickly as well. We work with international rugby players. We brought it to them. They brought it to World Rugby, and it was through in under a month. So, you know, a really nice example of a player trying to change things for the better. And yeah, quite a few positive comments around the stories, I think, from people who've, you know, experienced the same burns.
Had it reached a point where players were just fearing playing on these surfaces, particularly those who were susceptible to it? Because we've seen so many photographs of players who've had knees and elbows ripped up.
Yeah, I think, you know, the burns sit exterior to the wider kind of injury discussion because, and this is part of the reason why they kind of go under the radar, they're not a time loss injury generally. So they're not going to stop you playing on the weekend. And that's the thing that really drives, you know, the administrators of the game, that we don't want to see, you know, the megastars getting injuries that could be avoided and not being able to play. So they're just an unpleasant kind of side effect of playing on these pitches. And like I said, if we can help with that, then that's our role. In terms of the wider injury discussion, you know, you're absolutely right. Some guys don't like them. It's worth saying as well that some guys really do, some guys and girls. When we last surveyed our members, we were a bit surprised at the results we got, which was roughly a 50-50 split in terms of, you know, for and against. We're looking to survey our members again this autumn. So that was 2 or 3 years ago now. We're looking to survey our members again this autumn as to their opinions. So in terms of the wider injury discussion, we go off PRISP, which is the injury surveillance project that's run by the RFU and PRL. And it does show not so much that you get injured more. The rate of injury is pretty consistent between grass and artificial. It's more the severity and then the burden. So severity is how long you'll be injured for. So roughly 6 days longer if it's an artificial surface, and the burden is the combination of the two, and that's the one that everyone kind of uses because it tells you, you know, over 1,000 hours, you know, how many days are lost, basically.
I asked Rob Baxter about this the other day because for years he's been managing Jack Nowell, for example, to try and avoid him playing on those surfaces because Jack's knees would react badly and he'd have swelling and there'd be an impact in the week following the game. And his view was if the top 92 football clubs in the country are not allowed to use them for performance reasons, then why can 4 out of 13 Premiership clubs have to have them? Now, obviously, the Premier League and the Championship have significantly more money. But as the point I made to him near me, Sutton United got promoted to League Two and had to spend £500,000 changing their pitch. Rob Baxter's point was, he doesn't see the financial need for the clubs to use artificial surfaces. Do you feel that the end game here is that they'll end up having to be ripped up, or actually is it going to go the other way and we'll see more of them because of the financial benefits of having that surface you can train on, you can hire out for the community, all those other elements?
So as ever here, there's a huge amount of nuance to the argument. So whatever we do in the pro game will probably trickle down to the community. We know that, and that's sort of the responsibility we have. In terms of the community game, in terms of, you know, the local club, having an AGP is gold for them because, like you say, they can get the kids on it 7 days a week, 24/7, and it's fantastic. It never deteriorates. Now, relating that to the pro game where you've got, you know, the proper elite players, should they be playing on AGPs? That's the argument that I think that Rob's making there, because, you know, a lot of the clubs train on AGPs in the week as well. So it's not as black and white as rip them all up or not. Should we be using AGPs in the Prem? That's probably the more pertinent question. There was a moratorium in place for 3 years off the back of some work that we did at the RPA, saying that, you know, whilst this injury risk is a bit unknown, we shouldn't be putting any more down. That ended in the summer, and Gloucester put one down, obviously, straight away. They used some new research where they'd actually looked into individual pitches rather than just groupings. And that helped their cause. But like I said, I think there's still studies to be done around that foot interaction, around the lower limb injuries. And ultimately, the Premiership governs itself. We have to work to World Rugby regs. World Rugby say these pitches are okay. So that's why, you know, I've campaigned that players should be able to wear the leggings. If World Rugby say, you know, that the pitches are okay, let's let the players protect themselves. Now, if PRL want to say, as a league, we're going to insist that we play on natural surfaces, or hybrid seems to be the go-to at the moment, then that's a decision for the league. Now, again, you've got to caveat that slightly, because Franklin's Gardens, pitch I loved, pitch that everyone seems to think is the best pitch, it's a completely natural surface. There's no hybrid in there. There's no fibres. And it costs an awful lot of money to rip up that natural, beautiful surface that, you know, the likes of Wayne and Andy, the groundsman there, who I know well, you know, they love and care about. Tell them to rip it up and change it isn't easy for them to accept, because they, you know, a lot of people think that's the best pitch in the Prem. So I say it's not easy. The decision for the Prem is for the Prem owners to make, and for the PRL to make, about how they want their league to look and play. Ultimately, World Rugby say these pitches are suitable, and that's why the likes of Gloucester put one down in the summer.
You said the reaction to the leggings announcement was pretty positive. I'd imagine that's within the playing community who you represent. There wasn't widespread positive reaction. There was, I guess, some sniggers and some maybe fairly predictable responses from people who didn't like the idea of it. How do you respond to those who criticise the innovation?
Innovation is the right word, isn't it? Yeah, the game moves on. Some people did send me, you know, the game started out with players who were wearing trousers, by the way. So maybe we're just going a bit more old school. But like I say, that you've got to innovate. You can't sit still and say it should look the way it looked in the 70s. And that's rugby. Like, I just don't get the, you know, what difference it makes to you watching a game if someone's got a pair of tights on with shorts and socks over the top. I shrug my shoulders a bit. In terms of the players, you know, will every player wear them? Absolutely not. Do a lot of players already wear them in training? Yes, they do. So it's very much their choice. And it just seems common sense that if you are susceptible to these burns, if you've had them before, if they are unpleasant, you now have a chance at least to cover up and hopefully not get so many.
So a really serious point. I was at the Stoop last Friday and Joe Marler turned up in a crushed velvet tracksuit. Have you made sure there are some restrictions in place so that people like him can't wear fluorescent orange tights and use it to make their own statement? Because I think we've had enough of Joe's fashion sense.
You know, I think Joe takes delight in pushing the boundaries of what people say. You know, I did actually approach PRL and said, look, do you want to give some advice to the players? They were relatively flexible on it at that stage, but yeah, I think if Joe turns up in the leopard print, it might raise some eyebrows. I think most guys will just wear the black ones that they wear for training. But who knows? I mean, you know, some cynics have said, you know, more room for adverts and branding and everything else. So rather than tattooing the legs, they've got some leggings to put some stuff on now.
So that was Christian Day, and we will find out whether Joe Marler takes up that challenge of wearing these leopard print leggings. Now, we'll just round up this week's episode with our regular God or Goddess of the Week feature. Who would like to go first, Al or Stuart? Al's got his hand up.
Well, I thought I'd get mine in because it's probably a tad sadder, a tad more serious. Well, firstly, it was sad news broke overnight about Sean Wainui passed away in a in a traffic accident in New Zealand. We don't know too many details about that, but he's left behind a wife and two kids. Just want to say condolences to his family and everyone over there. You might have remembered him from last year. He broke the record in Super Rugby for scoring 5 tries in one game. But my God of the week is actually Keith Earls, who went public on television in Ireland at the weekend ahead of the release of his autobiography to talk about his struggles with being bipolar. Shed some light on the subject and said he was open to talk to players about it. It was a brave move from him, and I just thought it was a good opportunity to say good on him.
Good shout, Al. Stu?
Goddess of the week. The young lady whose name I shamefully didn't get, who before kickoff said, "Take out this gin and tonic. Have a really large one." She knew what was coming. Thank you.
As I watched, as I wrote my match report from that game, the Bath women's game went on in out on the field. About 3,000 people stayed at the Rec, and it was a cracking game. And actually, everyone who stayed on to watch that game left in far greater spirits than all those who had trooped out after the men's game. So well done to the ladies for playing and for about 3,000 people staying on to watch that. I don't think I can beat Al's nomination for Keith Earls. Mine would all have been rugby related. I just really enjoyed watching Billy Vunipola playing in a way that we know he can play and that we've been waiting for him to play. But that doesn't come close to Al's nomination for Keith Earls, who is this week's Ruck God of the Week. This has been the Ruck from the Times and the Sunday Times. We'll be back next week, but a bit later in the week, with a full autumn international preview. Please like and subscribe on your usual podcast outlet. We'll talk to you soon.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.